Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
Was on with me once before, and I thought we covered quite a bit of interesting topics. His name is William Konkoleski. He is the state director of Michigan MUFON, or MUFON, I should say, and he's with me this morning. It's been a while since I talked to Bill. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, it's always good to talk to you, and you know, as you get to talk to people a little more, you find that they have so much going on. Usually people that are drawn to certain things have so much more than we probably realize. And I guess the same is true with Bill. So how long have you been the director with MUFON in Michigan?
It's been 10 years now. January 2004 will be my 10 years as being the state director. I've been part of MUFON for 20 years and now state director for 10.
How long have you been in Michigan?
How long have I been in the state of Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
I've lived here all my life, if that's what you mean. I'm 42 currently. Grew up in Sterling Heights, and now I live in Clawson, which is not too far,
In the Detroit area. You got a couple of kids, you're married, so settle mm-hmm. down, and you like to, on the side, you like to explore UFOs, right?
Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing adventure. And as I take on the duties of, you know, being a great husband and great father, hopefully, this is still very much a central focus of what available free time I have when I can find some free time.
Why are you so interested in this, Bill?
Well, for me, it's always been part of my life. There was never a magic moment where UFOs came into my life. It goes all the way back probably to my earliest memory. I'll just come right out and say my earliest memory at age 2 is having a little gray guy looking at my crib. And from that point on, strange phenomena has always been part of my life. I will say, as some sort of clarification, my very earliest memories in life, I didn't know at the time, I should say, what to make of them.
Mm-hmm.
Just that little strange people were coming And later on, the connection, I suppose, was made with UFO phenomena. But strange things have always been part of my life, so I can't separate them from who I am. So, I do the best to investigate them and try to figure out what's going on.
And that's so true, I think, with so many of us that have had things happen. And usually it's going to spur you to want to learn more. At least it did for me as well. At a very young age, I had some things happen as well. Have you had, like, paranormal things happen as well?
Certainly, the house that I grew up in was a bit haunted, if I'll say that. I have 4 older brothers. The youngest of my older brothers is still 6 years older than me. And the house we grew up in had a lot of strange things going on. But since I was so much younger than the rest of my brothers, they kind of had an embargo on telling me about it because my parents didn't want to frighten me. So they all shared the information amongst themselves, the night the plant started shaking by itself, the ghost that floated through my brother's room, just strange things like that, the temperature changing quickly in certain rooms and coming back, and just a hodgepodge of little strange things going on in the house. For me, what I experienced are little people coming to visit me, which is interesting because it's not the experience my older brothers had. They had a different type of paranormal phenomena that was happening to them. And so that all of that should be happening in one house to just one family, to me, I think is pretty wild. And even more wild is to come into adulthood and find other cases where you have all sorts of different phenomena happening in a single place to a small group of people, then tends to be not that unusual at all.
No, it becomes like normal, doesn't it, William? You meet people that have had similar experiences. Now, when you said the Grays were visiting you at a young age, did you ever find out what they were doing? Did you ever do like hypnosis or anything? Or
yeah, when I got into contact with MUFON in 1993 and signed on right away because I was impressed with the amount of compassion they had and the depth of being able to investigate what was going on with me, I did some regressions back chiefly in 93, about half a dozen sessions, and looked over some of the details of what had happened to me. In some of the cases, new details were brought out about things that had happened to me in my younger years, primarily my teen years, where a lot of activity was happening. In some cases, though, the hypnosis was a way to validate what was happening to me, because under hypnosis, I was getting details about the house that I lived in that I had personally forgotten. That hypnosis brought out things that were able to be validated. So I was thinking, if hypnosis is enabling me to remember some of these things from childhood that I had forgotten, which could be proven, and it also is strengthening my memories of some of the more strange things that had happened to me, it's quite likely that hypnosis is actually a reliable tool when used properly to be able to pull out some of these types of memories.
I've always felt Bud Hopkins... I don't know how you feel about Bud, but when I first started reading his stuff, I really felt he was on the right track to helping people recover memories of what happened to him. Do you know what happened to, do you recall being taken aboard? Did they do things to you? Do you know anything like that?
Yeah, there were a couple incidents that were highly memorable in that respect. When I was 7... I was brought on board, and they probably best to sort of walk through the events as they happened. I was laying in bed, and this black hole, this black sort of portal opened up over the bed, and out of this portal, this silvery, metallic, snake-like thing exited out of this portal, started whipping around above my head, and electricity was shooting off of it. And as the electricity was kicking off of it, my body started to feel heavy vibrations. And then I felt like I was actually pulled through that portal. Then I found myself in a little room with two little gray guys. Very small room. And the light in the room was a dark gray purple. It almost had an effect of like a ultraviolet light. And they brought me... I knew I had to wait in that room for a moment. I had a feeling that I was being cleansed somehow, or they wanted me in that room to make sure everything was okay with me before they let me on board. And then, so they brought me into the next room where there was an examination table, and the little gray guys went out through another door, left me in the room by myself. They didn't restrain me in any way, and so as a nervous and curious 7-year-old, I decided to take a look around. I found my way out through another door and walking down a hallway. It didn't take them very long to realize that I had left the room, and so they came out and they were following me. They didn't seem to care that I was loose on their shift. They didn't do anything except follow me from several paces back. So I went down the hallway as far as I could. It dead-ended, and I knew I had to come back. And it seemed like they always knew that that would have been the case, and that's probably why I'm so concerned with letting me loose.
So you didn't feel go ahead, Bill.
At the time, I don't remember more than a level of nervousness that met with curiosity. When you're a kid, and this is just my perspective from an adult looking back, I'm not a child psychologist by any means, it's just what the best way I think I can maybe describe it. When you're a kid, people bring you to all sorts of places. You have no idea where you're going from day to day sometimes. You have no understanding about what the greater world is around you. So you always have that sort of sense that a lot of things happen in my life that I just don't understand, and I just kind of have to go with it. And to me, there was that looking back and that feeling I had under regression was that this was one of those times where I'm in this situation, can't do anything about it so much, so I'm just going to go with it to the best of my ability. With regards to the little gray guys, I had seen them several times in my life by this point, so they weren't novel to me anymore. And for the most part, they were pretty friendly to me. And so I didn't have an innate nervousness of them just simply because they took me or because of the situation. So, again, I think my curiosity was probably on par with my nervousness of the situation at that time.
I guess, you know, go ahead, Bill. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I've talked to a lot of different people. Some people have had what they call, well, they're a little bit terrified because they don't understand. But then I think there are some people that have had experiences that are truly wonderful. Mm-hmm. Would you describe yours as more in that direction?
Depends on the type of experience and depends at what time of life it happens. I'll finish this story, and then because I'm almost done with it, because the most wild part of this particular account is what happens next. As I return to them, they escort me into this side room where there's a chair that looks like a dentist chair. There's another little gray being in there that's just a little bit taller than they are, tells me to get in the chair, and for some reason I comply, and says, okay, we're going to do some stuff to you, but if you get if you're really good, we're going to show you the color blue. And to me, as a little 7-year-old, I'm like, well, you know, suckers work, you know, candy works, stickers work, you know, you're going to show me the color blue. So I'm sitting in the chair, and the being looks, is very close to my face, just staring at me. And I feel this pain in my right arm. I look, and I see a cut across my right arm, healing right as I'm watching it. It's healing over. And I look at the thing and to ask it, you know, what the heck did you do that for? And then it's still very close to my face, and its eyes that were a dark, liquidy black suddenly seem to be backlit, a bright, really bright light, sort of like a cerulean blue. And I was just totally mesmerized by this thing's eyes. I passed out, woke up in bed the next morning. I had a scar on my arm that wasn't there before. And just as a little unusual way to actually end this specific account, I was in the backyard playing with a friend the next day when this vaporous cloud rolled into the backyard. Inside the cloud was a little gray guy that came up to me and asked me if I was all right, and I said I was, and then the little gray guy in the cloud just rolled out into the neighbor's backyard and kept going.
No kidding. Wow.
So, and, you know, some people say, well, how can you just come out and tell these stories? You know, how can you just, like, oh, and, you know, I went to the store the other day, and, oh, there was another time I had an alien account, you know, just sort of matter-of-factly. It's just that I've been telling these accounts so many times at this point that, well, it just seems easy to, you know, to come out with them.
That, Bill, but I would say, you know, it is matter-of-fact. Like everything in life, once you get past the fear, it's mm-hmm. all part of what we do. Mm-hmm. So I look at it that way, too. When somebody, if I have something happen to me, now I just kind of matter of fact, that's part of this world that we live in. There's so many dimensions to it, and there's so many unseen things that exist, and they just become normal, and I think they should be. Go ahead, Bill.
And, to touch on the other question that you had, my very first experiences with these little gray guys was that they wanted to be my playmates. They wanted to play with me, and they were very friendly and childlike and very endearing. As I got into my teen years, it seemed that they were more business. They were more interested in doing things with me physically, and they weren't anywhere near as joyful or playful when I was younger, when I think they went through that bonding phase with me, and now they were, okay, we're on a tight schedule, we need you to lay on this table, and we're going to do this and that. Then after that, it seemed as I got into my 20s, they had a very keen interest in the direction that my life was going. and in a great way that it involved the women I was dating, girls I was dating at the time. And from that point, when I think that they felt that my life was on a track that they were comfortable with, they eased back in a great way. And some of the experiences I started to have as I got into my 20s were gentler. Again, they were more wondrous and respectful of me again. It seemed like they were, okay, you know, we are, I wouldn't say equals now, but somehow I was a made man in respect of the level of nicety that they were suddenly granting me.
Do you think,
as I got...
Do you think your attitude had anything to do with that, Bill? Do you think that they were reflecting, you know, because I've heard people say more than once, how we perceive them or the situation is kind of what we're going to experience.
I do think that's very true. I also, on that note, think that it's not necessarily contrary to my personal experience. Certainly, as a child, they weren't doing anything harmful. My memory at age 7 was the first time that I had any memory of them doing something unpleasant toward me, which is making the cut on my arm, which I still have the scar. But prior to that, it seemed very intentional, like they were trying to guide the mood. And the experiences that I had in my teen years, the things that they were doing, there isn't a way to say, okay, they put me on a table, they put something up my nose, I had blood all over my face, which they panicked, and they had to try to figure out how to clean it up so it wouldn't stain my clothes. I don't know if I can say that, you know, just depending on mood, one could necessarily put a positive spin on that. You know, I got this feeling of joy and love as they crammed something up my nose. You know, it doesn't quite jive. But I will say those times that they didn't necessarily, weren't jostling me around or needing to apparently fit me into whatever schedule they had, and so they were just all business. Like, I do think that attitude is a big part of it. And those times where they seek sort of communion, want to check in on my life, see how things are going. If I had an attitude of fear, I would say, oh my gosh, they're stalking me. If I had a full and open loving attitude, I could, you know, my perception might be, oh my goodness, my old friend, you know, came in to drop on me and see how I'm doing, you know, that sort of thing. So mood and attitude for a lot of this, sure, I think, do play some part. Some of the things, you know, you just look at the actual facts of what happened and, you know, your mood and attitude can play a part in maybe your healing process if they're doing something that you ordinarily wouldn't let them do, but, you know.
What do you think they were trying to do, Bill? What do you think they were trying to do?
I think that their keen interest tended to be maybe twofold. In my years where I was highly virile, I guess, there was an interest and the reproductive side of me. And so they had a scientific interest in me. As I got older, I think they understood that I was somebody that was in a position to be a spokesperson of the phenomena, and they probably thought it was important to manage that relationship with me, to put it in a business sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, in respect to that, in my adult years, I think part of the reason that I've, you know, seen the respect that I've gotten from them is that, you know, okay, you know, you're a spokesperson for us and the phenomena that happens, and you connect with other people who have the same type of phenomena. You know, there's many people out there I've met whose timeline of, you know, experience you know, is quite close to mine. So, you know, I think that it helps now that if I'm not in a position of abject fear where I'm afraid to sleep with the lights off, that it's a lot easier for me to connect with other people who've had this type of experience. And I think to them, you know, they see value in that, that the people that they come into their life, that those people are able to function. I think it's important to them.
What do you think they're trying to accomplish? Do you have any idea why this is going on?
In terms of a big picture, what I ultimately feel about that goes pretty far down the rabbit hole, as I tend to say. On a surface level, I think that as a species from elsewhere, they're fascinated in us the same way that we're fascinated with creatures in, you know, out in the wilderness. You know, we build zoos because we're fascinated with seeing other life forms. I think to some extent, there's that curiosity about us. So they're always going to be curious about us as a life form and seeing us in our natural habitat. I think just on a curiosity basis alone, that would keep them coming back for a long time. On the to take it down the rabbit hole a bit further, I don't think that all of the experiences that happen are physical. I think some of them are out of body or you know, on an astral plane or a plane of consciousness, whatever the term you know, people like to use. And I think in those experiences, you really are on a level of parity with them because it's no longer they're a technologically superior creature and you're dealing with them on their terms. But if you are both on a plane of consciousness, I think there's a great better level of parity with them. And I do think they operate on a level of consciousness to a great extent. I don't think that we're probably that far beyond, behind until we start to understand that people, our consciousness can possibly be taken outside of our body, maybe plugged into a machine, as strange as that sounds, or, you know, something along those lines, and then we start to look at life and the universe and all sorts of things like planes of consciousness in a whole new way. I know that was taking things pretty far, pretty fast.
No, that's not taking it too far for me. Do you think that they were trying to procreate with us?
I don't think I think that they had a good level of success. I think in our level of backward technology, probably in the grand scheme of things amongst all technologically advanced species, we're still probably in a very archaic phase. And yet we're still able to map DNA. We're still able to fuse species of plants or whatever together. And I think that at their level of technology, that they probably did have an interest in trying to procreate mixed species, then I do think that they had a level of success with that.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of people that have experienced that and have actually even been, you know, if you believe the people that have been eyewitnesses to that, have seen their children at some point, more than once, have been shown the cross. And, you know, and I've heard speculation that the reason they're doing that is because they want to breed maybe some emotion. They're a very intelligent group of beings that pretty much use their mind, but they don't maybe have the emotion part. Maybe that's why they don't understand us when we get upset. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what the theory that I've heard, that they've kind to, they're trying to bring some of that back into their life.
My sense in that is taking what I was saying a moment ago to the next step, is that I think once consciousness can be popped out of a physical form and put into another physical form, when dealing on the physical level, not necessarily on the level of consciousness, but when dealing on the physical level, you can put consciousness into something that doesn't necessarily naturally feel emotion. Like if you were to top consciousness out and put it into a computer, where is the part in that computer that feels emotion? There really isn't anything there. You could be aware, and you could be aware that you're a machine, but, you know, the chemicals that create emotions, the sort of bond you feel with other living beings because you're part of a natural creative process that, you know, of nature, of life, if you become something sort of unnatural, become something, a consciousness form, and something fabricated, yeah, you're going to lose that connection with emotion. And so one theory, which I tend to see is possibly very likely, is that these gray beings are almost drones. They're created, they're fabricated, they have consciousness in them that can be plugged in and taken out, but there's nothing in this makeup of a being that expresses that joy, that emotion. And so their experiments with us are like, let's see if we can take these drone forms that we have and create a hybrid where it can feel that emotion, it can feel that joy in the physical sense. And so that would explain why they want to procreate with us, and, you know, for whatever reason that it is able to give them emotion and whatever value they find in that. I think that's probably down the road. I think that's probably, if I had to maybe take a stab at it, what I think is going
maybe
on.
Maybe, Bill, they just think you're cute. Maybe they want some of that.
That would be the scariest thing out there.
So, with now that you've had these experiences, you say you really don't, you're not afraid of it.
Not in the same way. And the reason is that I think they come from a place of consciousness, and that's a place where we naturally reside. In many ways, there's a part of us that operates on that level of consciousness, like when we go to sleep. A lot of times in dreams, we can access that degree of consciousness. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of times people leave their bodies in sleep and can access that consciousness naturally and walk around in it. And at that point, you really are on a level of equality with any other being that's there on the plane of consciousness. So these experiences that now happen, and to me, it, speaking from a personal perspective, in a purely physical way, that's their awkward attempt of saying, okay, I'm a being of consciousness, now I'm in this physical form, and we're going to interact, and it's going to be awkward, because that this is not necessarily our, you know, this is not our natural form. And we understand that your species thinks that this physical form is your natural form, so we have to sort of play along with you, or if we try to convince you otherwise, now we have to deal with that drama.
Mm-hmm.
So, I do think the whole thing's kind of awkward, and I see the humor in it, but I do think that understanding that I have that, you know, it is awkward for them. They're trying to do their best. They're at least the beings that I've seen and encountered, and for most people, there's not anything malevolent, malevolent in what's going on.
Do you think, Bill, that they're trying to help us? I mean, as far as so we don't destroy ourselves or kind of like oversee the planet, have been maybe doing that for a while?
Well, I think that it wouldn't best serve them if we destroyed ourselves. I think we're a rich source of context for them, that they're able to learn a lot from us, and I think that probably life, you know, is so precious in the universe that they're going to try to save every possible opportunity of a civilization to be able to grow and advance. And, you know, if our planet is, you know, we're not the only species on here, you know, we have this lush, wonderful planet full of life, I think that's a real gem, probably. And so I think that to the extent that they want to make sure we survive, at least as species, at least to some extent, they're sort of caretakers of this world, and making sure that we don't make ultimately bad mistakes.
And they probably have been here a long time.
Yeah. You know, I've heard that, you know, some of the way that some of the people describe it is that they've been here longer than we have.
Hmm. Is there any more you want to talk about as far as other experiences?
For myself, not necessarily, I guess. I do think that my book, okay, plug for my book.
Sure.
Because it's the best. My book is Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds. It's available on Amazon or other places online. Sometimes like Barnes & Noble, I know, has it. It's about my personal experiences up to about age 20. The book covers the idea of what it's like to be a child going through these types of experiences from that perspective, growing up in a world that says this type of thing doesn't exist, yet it's happening to you on a regular basis. So, dealing with that. There are possibly other books I'll put down the road about experiences that I've had in later years. That might not be anytime soon. But, you know, I'm always available to discuss if anybody wants to get in touch with me about my personal stuff.
Well, that's cool. I'm glad you shared that. And we're going to hopefully talk about that again down the road somewhere. As the state director of MUFON in Michigan, how many cases were reported this year?
This year so far, we're at the last count, I thought it was 287 when I checked yesterday.
Now you go ahead.
Yeah, and that's actually somewhat typical for us. We get about 250 sightings a year, and this is not just sightings that we say, oh, we've identified this many sightings in Michigan. Now every one of these sightings that we count, again, this is just in Michigan, 287 this year. These are sightings where people directly came to us, approached us, and told us their UFO sighting. So if you think that, you know, on a regular basis we're receiving, or in many cases like this, exceeding 250 sightings a year, that means that the UFO sighting is not going away anytime soon, mm-hmm. probably.
No.
It means that it's a lot bigger than a lot of people tend to think. MUFON International itself, you know, of course, then the music gets thousands of sightings every year. And, yeah, that's, a lot for somebody to actually see something, decide to tell anybody about it, and then decide that they want to tell strangers the fact that they find probably through the internet, like MUFON, about, you know, report their sighting to a group like us. And, you know, when you think if we're receiving this many sightings, that means there are probably many more,
yeah,
that aren't reported.
I know so many people that would never report it, and they've told me because I've gained their confidence in my own experiences, too, I've had. Or time passes, you know, and then, you know, maybe it's too late to go back and talk about that. But you also said that a lot of these things are explained away. Right? You said there, what was it you were saying that a bunch of people saw, what was the Chinese what?
Chinese lanterns.
Chinese lanterns. And they thought they were UFOs?
Yeah, that is unfortunately a big percentage of our sightings lately. Yeah, it's not that when I say 250 sightings a year, that's 250 anomalous sightings a year. Out of that, it really is just a small percentage that are high strangeness and or anomalous, and that you still get some very interesting cases out of that. However, the Chinese lantern, basically, in a nutshell, you could stick a candle under a little garbage bag and send it off into the air as a mini hot air balloon is, you know, sort of a plain way to describe what these things are. But they have nice packaged versions of these that you can buy at fireworks places. Somebody said they even saw them at CVS. People let them off at weddings. People let them off at funerals. People let them off. The more, the merrier, basically. It's not usually the case where you see somebody that's going to let off one of these. Usually they let off half a dozen,
and
a
so
dozen,
people,
however many they can afford.
People will look at them and that's the way I look at it, too. It's like, come on, really? It's like, it's got to do something remarkable for me to say, okay, I really don't know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a light in the sky that's moving, I'm going to usually think it's just a plane or a jet. Mm-hmm. So, well, go ahead.
In the case of the Chinese lanterns, when you see them, depending on how far away they are, people that see them at a relatively close distance will see this flame just moving through the sky. And that may panic them. That may make them curious, why is there this fire just moving through the sky? When they report a UFO sighting to us, it's not always just that they think, let me bounce this off of you to think that you might come back and say it's extraterrestrial. It's just that I saw something I could not identify in the sky. I saw this flame going through. Are you guys familiar with why I would be literally fire in the sky?
Right.
If they see it at a further distance, the flickering of the flame, they might not be able to detect the flame itself, but they might be able to see sort of the flickering they might interpret as a strobing. And if they see multiple lanterns together, the eyes can do some pretty interesting things. Mm-hmm. They could see it as a formation of flying, glowing objects or they could look at some of these lights and think that they're actually the perimeter of a physical object and think, oh my gosh, I saw this giant craft that had lights all the way around it, when really it's just a formation of these lanterns. And they do look pretty spooky. I have seen a couple of formations of these in the sky just driving around without even trying to look for them. And, yeah, they do look a little unusual. But at no point, from my perspective, ever looking at them, did I think, this
right.
is something spooky. It's just
what to look for, too. There's also maybe for people, when you've seen things, you kind of know what to look for a little bit as well. Now, we talked about, before we did this, there were some incidents. There was an incident you referred to with a fellow by the name of Donald. Pretty amazing story. Back in the 60s, was that when it took place?
Over the summer in Michigan, in Wellston, Michigan, somebody had seen, it was July 31st, probably I think the 28th was the actual date of the sighting. This gentleman was at a trailer out in the woods, went out to relieve himself and saw a giant flying cigar with just flying over the tops of the trees, which probably helped him relieve himself. But it had three portholes on it, and looking at the illustration that the person drew of this, the first thing that I thought of was that this looked remarkably like the craft from 1964, this gentleman, Donald Shrum, that's Shrum, Shrum, had seen out in California. This is sometimes alternately known as the Cisco Grove incident, based upon the campground that they were at when he had seen this thing. This guy and two buddies, going back to the 60s version, he went bow hunting with his two friends, and when they got there, they decided to split up, and he went out on his own and realized that he had gone so far that he couldn't make it back by the time that the sun went down, and that there was no way he was going to find it back to the campground otherwise, so he decided to camp out in the woods and trying to avoid bear or other possible unsavory creatures out there. He climbed a tree and saw what appeared that he thought was a search helicopter out in the distance. So he came down out of his tree and he built these three signal fires. And turned out what he drew to him was not actually a search helicopter, but it was a large cigar-shaped object with three portholes.
Hmm.
Now, the current case in Michigan from over the summer, the individual that saw this, they only saw the craft, and then the craft floated away silently, and that was the end of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily for the guy in Michigan, because what happened to the gentleman in California back in the 60s was a lot more scary. As he was watching this cigar-shaped object, this again is Donald Trump back in 1964, out of the object came a smaller sort of a pod that landed in the woods. Out of this pod came a collection of creatures. There were five little beings that were probably grays based upon the way that he described them. But also with these five little grays were two robots, full-on, walking, mechanical men. Came out of this thing with these five little guys. He said that the five little guys seemed almost indifferent to him for the most part. They didn't really care any more for him than they did about the bushes that they were inspecting and samples that they were taking. But these robots seemed to have the one explicit purpose, which was to try to capture Shrum. So he is back up in his tree at this point, and one of the robots came under the tree, and amazingly, according to Shrum's story, this thing opened its mouth, and this vapor came out, which made Shrum black out, which made and every time he blacked out, he would fall across his bow that he had perched up in these branches. He would wake up a few moments later and see that the thing was still down there, and then when the thing would realize he was awake again, it would let out this vapor. Pretty soon, Shrum decides to fight back against these things, and he's got a book of matches with him, and he starts lighting things and throwing down at him. He lights his shoes, he lights his hat, really? He starts taking money out of his wallet and lighting that on fire and throwing it down at him, and it makes them back up. He also, since he has a bow and arrow weapon, he actually shoots the robot 3 times, and he manages to strike it every time with his bow and arrow, and the arrows just knock off he hits it in the chest, and it just bounces off this thing, and the arrows just land in the wood. So at this point, the second robot gets in on the act, and they're both letting out vapor, and Shrum is really nervous at this point that they might be able to actually draw him out of the tree, so he wraps his belt around himself in the tree to make sure he won't fall out. And every time these two robots are letting out this noxious gas to knock him out, now the 5 little gray guys are also involved in this, and they're trying to climb up the tree also to try to get him down. And at one of the points where they're doing this, Shrum passes out. He becomes unconscious because that's what keeps happening over and over again. One of the times he wakes up, it's suddenly daylight, and all the UFO is gone. The little guys are gone, and the robots are gone. So that was quite a harrowing experience, obviously, for this guy. He climbs out of the tree. He makes his way back to the camp. One of his friends actually witnessed the UFO that had come to get Shrum in the night, but didn't, you know, he only saw the UFO, not the rest of what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Shrum collects his arrows and actually passes them on to the Air Force to investigate, or I should say he passed one of them on to the Air Force to investigate. Never got the arrow back or any other details about their investigation of the arrow. And he manages to lose the other two arrows, I guess, when he's moving houses at some point. And NICAP investigated this case. AFRO investigated this case. MUFON investigated this case. And Shrum just recently passed away, but you know, all of these investigative organizations that looked at his case found it to be quite compelling, quite that the gentleman was quite credible. And they, you know, his story has pretty much held up.
Interesting. That's an amazing story. I'm sure there's so many of them. You and I were talking before we did the interview, and you mentioned that there seems to be, when people have experiences with UFOs, there also is poltergeist activity as well. And and it made me think of, you know, somebody I know personally that is right now having some of that going on, but they also had UFO activity more than once, and they told me that they filmed it on video. But what is the connection that you see with that, Bill?
And going back a little bit to the part where I was trying to explain, probably a bit quick and dirty about the beings being essentially consciousness that can plug themselves into a physical form. When these things are in their natural state of consciousness, there are a lot of things that exist naturally in a form of consciousness, like spirits. When people die, they become spirit, they become consciousness. These things have found a way to be in that level of consciousness through technology. Also, there are some beings, I'm certain, out there that have always existed in some sort of form of consciousness, not necessarily passed on, you know, people or technological beings that have managed to find access to the form of consciousness. But I think there's a huge, vast array of different beings and different types of minds out there in this great field of consciousness. So I think when a person has a poltergeist experience, or sees a ghost, or sees a UFO, possibly even a cryptid, what they're doing is they're tuning in to that field of consciousness where these things inhabit naturally, all of these different types of phenomena, ghosts, aliens,
etc. So would you say that if you have an alien encounter, UFO encounter, does it raise your ESP level where these other things that are invisible now start to become visible?
Exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. Your antenna goes up. Once you catch the signal of one of these types, during one of these types of events, it triggers something in your energy, is one way to maybe put it, so that you are able to detect things more easily, more readily. And so other type of phenomena that come from consciousness are a lot more accessible to you. You see a UFO, suddenly you're plugged into that, dimension of consciousness. So now you draw in poltergeist activity and all this other stuff because now you're plugged in.
Why do you think that certain people are taken or have experiences and others don't? Are we chosen, or is it part of an agreement, or what do you think that is, Bill?
That one's hard to say because I don't know, for example, what happened to me before I was born, to say whether or not I made contact. I don't even have a good sense of whether or not I did or would have made any type of pact. But I think it is possible, as one source of possibility, I guess, is that if somebody is predisposed to experiencing things from that level of from the world of consciousness, it's possible that they are physiologically changed in such a way that they can pass it through their children, or they can possibly pass this along. So some people may be genetically more able to detect things around them that other people can't. And so it could be, that could be the source of it. I think that there are certainly cases where people didn't start off in their life a path where they were going to naturally experience all sorts of this type of phenomena, but suddenly do experience, something that they can't explain, and then that opens up that third eye, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, is it possible, Bill, that we also can create this while we're here? Like you said earlier, that we can leave our bodies, and mm-hmm. and we can almost meet up with these beings. Could we work out arrangements at that point, while we're here?
Yeah, I don't see why not. If somebody is able to either master the art of traveling out of body, or it happens accidentally, and that spirit goes wandering around and meeting all the other things that are out there, they could probably bring back, either intentionally or unintentionally, some of this type of phenomena. That sounds very likely.
You know, when you talked about the robot, it really, it's funny because you hear things throughout your life and you store them away. That's what I do. And I don't, at the time, I don't have an answer, but I keep it in my mind. There was a woman I worked with maybe, 10, 15 years ago. She told me when her father was young, and this has to go back in the 50s, he was in his teens, and he came home late one night to the farm, and on the way into the house, he looked over, and there was this robotic-type thing standing there, and it was making some kind of electrical sound or doing something. And she told me he didn't bother to talk to it. He just ran into the house. And that's the only time that he ever told her about that. But at least what you're telling me with this Donald Shrum supports you know, that other people have had experiences with these kind of things. And I'm sure there's many other stories out there. What do you know about in Michigan? Now, we have our buddy that lives in Pennsylvania that really is into this topic, but the connection, because more than one person has made this connection, Sasquatch and UFOs. Have you had cases like that in Michigan?
In Michigan, we have had people that have seen UFOs who have also seen Bigfoot. I can count amongst my closest personal friends, actually, two people who have seen both the UFOs and Bigfoot. They have not seen them together, though there are certainly many cases where it appears that the UFOs have dropped off the Bigfoot, strangely enough. I know it's odd to just, you know, say that, but you have to think, you know, with as long as people have been encountering the Bigfoot phenomena, and with as, you know, pretty much zero evidence in the way of finding any sort of bodies or, you know, being able to capture one. Certainly there's been some exciting studies done on some hair samples. But, you know, beyond that, it's like, where do these things come from? Mm-hmm. Where do they go? How come so many people see them everywhere? You know, they're everywhere.
They're up here.
They're all, they're, you know, there's these, every site, state probably has their own giant library of Bigfoot sightings. So, you know, where, you know, why is it that, you know, we haven't made some real progress of cornering them? And one good reason is that possibly they're not naturally from here, or they have the ability to pop in and out of some other dimension, and possibly with the aid of UFOs or whatever other type of strange visitations we're having to our world that are responsible for ushering in and ushering out odd creatures like Bigfoot. Bigfoot creatures also tend to have some strange powers to them.
Mm-hmm.
They a lot of times they have almost a psychic effect on the witness and have the ability to disappear instantly. Sometimes you have experiences where people try to track the Bigfoot, and their footprints just simply disappear in the middle of a field.
Right.
Where did they go?
There is there's a man who I've tried to interview, but, you know, I respect people's privacy. Somebody I knew was related to this individual. This is actually within a few miles from my house. I live out in the country. He goes hunting every year, and nobody wants to go hunting with him because they're afraid, because when he goes out to his blind, he hunts in this one section. Well, in that area, and I've heard it from his wife, that they see a big hairy thing, and there's all these lights around it.
Hmm.
And that's the definition I've been given. And I was hoping that he would come on with me someday, but maybe, you know, maybe that'll change. But it certainly supports, you know, that there could be, it's certainly not any ape or anything. It's definitely a Sasquatch that he's seeing. And he's Native American. And also it seems like it happens more with the Native American people, too.
Mm-hmm.
They're connected to it. My studies have shown me that they seem to be connected to these kind of things. And see,
I believe that.
And so there's an incident, you know, and then not far from where I live, a couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, there were two. The farm is 3/4 mile from my house. I live in a good spot, I'm telling you, Bill. And this farmer in his field had two crop circles. And there aren't a whole lot reported up here in Upper Michigan. But I thought it was kind of neat. And they actually had somebody come in and test them to make sure that they weren't, you know, done boarding, I guess is one way that they do those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they came to the conclusion, they don't know what caused it, but it just kind of pushed the stuff down. It didn't board them down. I'm guessing that could be faked as well.
And yeah, most crop circles, unfortunately, are fake. I know. I also know a lot of proppies very personally well. The people that do the investigation, it's their nickname for themselves. You know, they say that you know, the few ones that they can count as authentic, you know, are highly interesting. However, most of the ones tend to be fake, yeah, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's plenty that do that. So we're just about out of time. I think this is incredibly fascinating. I thought we were going to talk about cases going into you know, what you've reported, but I much would rather hear about your own personal experiences and, you know, interesting stories like Donald Shrum and all those other connections, because people out there are having these experiences. And I'm thinking right now, Bill, maybe they hear something and they go, hey, that happened to me, or I know somebody that happened to, you know.
Yeah, I guarantee it.
And so they can maybe look into it. If you want to get Bill's book, Experiencer Raised in Two Worlds is the name of it, right?
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you want to contact Bill, what's the best way to do that?
Probably through the Michigan MUFON website. My contact information is there. The website is MIMUFON.org. If you also just Google Michigan UFO, you'll find our site right away.
Now, are you open to, I know you pretty much investigate UFOs, but do you look into other paranormal things as well? If somebody said, hey, Bill, something really weird happened.
It depends on what it is. Either, I would be able to take some involvement. We have some investigators that are great in our state that, focus on different key areas of investigation. Or, I know somebody, I have close friends, of course, that do Bigfoot investigations primarily, crop circle investigations primarily, ghost investigations primarily. So if I, am not qualified, which is very true in some cases, I know somebody very closely who I definitely recommend. That's what you're asking.
Anything else you want to add at all today, Bill?
No, except if you are interested in the UFO phenomena and you live in Michigan, please look up our state chapter. We have meetings that are 5 times a year in Flint. You can find details on the website. If you happen to be, for example, in Wisconsin, look up your Wisconsin chapter, or wherever you might live, look up your state's MUFON chapter, and you probably find that they have regular MUFON meetings as well to get together and, share your accounts, your guest speakers, all that sorts of things. We're good people, and the meetings are always a good time. And if you are interested in investigating UFOs yourself, well, we have plenty for you to investigate.
There's plenty of sightings. Do you get a lot of reports from Upper Michigan?
It's across the board. Usually the rule of thumb is where there are more people, you get more sightings. If you put the, as you can do, even if you go to MUFON.com, the international website, and plug in, you pick a state, and like say Michigan, and say, give me the last 100 sightings, what you're basically going to see is a population map. Most of the sightings that'll be on the map are in southeastern Michigan, and you'll find some in the Grand Rapids area, anywhere, Traverse City, anywhere where there's more people. If you put enough sightings on the map, actually, you'll even be able to plot out I-75, interestingly enough, as a regular thing. So it's usually where there's people, there's sightings.
And the sightings don't interest me as much as it's the interaction, the second level or third level where they have some kind of contact, because it's hard to prove something that you see. Now, if somebody approaches you, Bill, you guys are pretty open about all this, and you're going to be scientific, but they don't have to feel like they're going to be ridiculed in any way. And can they remain anonymous?
Sure. All sightings that we get are anonymous. The information that we receive, for example, if you report your sighting to us, somebody from your state will, the MUFON investigator from your state will follow up with you to hear more about your sighting and then see how far an investigation might merit. But although your information gets entered into our database, if somebody who is not a state investigator from MUFON is looking at our MUFON.com site at the recent sightings that come in, your information is blocked out. So it's completely anonymous. So everyone can feel confident that, the information that comes in is going to remain anonymous. For example, like the sighting that I was speaking about earlier in Michigan about the person that had the cigar-shaped craft, they haven't given us permission to give their name, so heck no, I'm not going to give their name. That person that I brought up from the 60s, Donald Trump, he's gone very public about his sighting, so obviously,
Well, that's
he's
cool.
Okay with this.
Because most people, I think, are afraid of what they're going to get, what kind of their neighbors, their family. I think that's what keeps a lot of people from speaking up. And so many people, it's, you know, we have a small percentage that talk about it when it's an overwhelming number that don't talk about it, the way I feel about it. So thank you very much, William Konkoleski. He's the state director, Michigan MUFON, and I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me on the show again.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.